What a difference a year makes. You may think not a lot can change in that time, but most programs at Salt Lake Tech can be completed in 6 to 18 months. Last year, I was working odd jobs. This year, I'm building my future with a new career as a certified nursing assistant. Earning a certificate is affordable and flexible and gets me career ready. Explore programs in healthcare, electronics, manufacturing, automotive, and more. Enroll at slcc.edu. Salt Lake Tech, careers that work.
You're listening to Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, now in the running for America's most trusted source for cultural commentary about comedy news. That is our topic today, the plethora of current places where humor and news are combined. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer, reporting on location from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Al Baker, occupying a distinctly awkward place in our political culture.
I'm Sarah Lynn Bruck, and I remember when satirical news was funny.
Wow. My name is Lawrence Ware, and the only news like this that I consume is Arsenio Hall.
I remember that guy.
Is he still on the airwaves somewhere?
He's still not doing it.
He doesn't have a podcast? Okay.
No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't.
I have not kept up with Arsenio. I'm a religious watcher of John Oliver.
Me too.
I love that.
And I watched John Stewart back in the day and have kind of most of the time have been watching him since his return and occasionally the other days of that. And my news feed will feed me Stephen Colbert and a closer look and just other things. So sometimes I'll check those out. I was looking at this book that I had had for a while, but had not actually started. That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them.
Mm.
It's from about 2021.
Interesting.
So I took in a little Gutfeld this time. And of course, there's SNL and Dennis Miller, and I was reviewing Not Necessarily the News, and you had referred, Al, to the Frost Report, which I didn't realize is comedy news, satirical news going all the way back to the 60s, but of course, there's some of that in Monty Python, so I knew it was in the British. What are other people's priors, or how are you approaching this?
So comedy news has been a really big thing for me for most of my life. My kind of bigoted cultural assumption coming into this is that, like almost anything else that is culturally significant or good, satirical news originated in the UK.
Oh, come on.
I think it was the Queen herself. The Queen invented it.
Maybe not everything, but I think certainly in the case of modern satirical news and maybe even modern satire itself, we can fairly lay claim to having invented the current form. And I think it's fair to say that the Frost Report is the first modern example of satirical news as such, as in like someone doing satire, but in the form of a news program of some kind. But we've also had incredibly long-running satirical shows. Panel shows in particular seems to be a very like English format. And we've had a program called The News Quiz, which has run on the radio since the 60s, I think. But aside from satirical news as such, we also saw the birth of what I would describe as modern satire from beyond the fringe onwards. Beyond the Fringe was an Oxford Review show featuring such luminaries as Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and Alan Bennett, who are all famous for other reasons now. But that was an extremely, at the time, extremely provocative and controversial satire show, which made it to Broadway eventually, but was really kind of the leading voice. Collectively, they were like the leading voices in post-war irreverence, which was hugely consequential in the culture in the UK. And Peter Cook, he had an incredible career, but among other things, he went on to found Private Eye, which is an extremely, well-respected isn't exactly the right term, but influential satirical newspaper in the UK, which certainly laid the groundwork for things like National Lampoon, Mad Magazine, except that Private Eye is much more in the vein of doing serious investigative journalism. They're very, very good at uncovering corruption and scandals and hypocrisy. And it's never a good day for someone in government when their name turns up in Private Eye. So this is a form with a really, really long and strong tradition in the UK. And it's been interesting over the last couple of decades seeing America like become the undisputed champion in terms of putting out this kind of work, with particularly the rise of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. And it's also been interesting to see occasional attempts to more directly appropriate the like panel show format in the US, and that just never seems to work as well.
Sarah, what's your consumption of this?
Sounds a lot like your list. I do remember Not Necessarily the News when we would travel as a family. that would be the times when we would get to see HBO, like in a hotel or something. Mm-hmm. So we adored that show at the time. And you sent out the hour-long YouTube clip video. And I was kind of astonished at how not funny and how it is today. I mean, you know, this is the kind of humor that doesn't age particularly effectively, but that definitely was not hilarity that I remembered. But I watched John Oliver again. That's appointment television for me. Now that John Stewart's back, we watch The Monday Show, and sometimes we'll watch later in the week too. But I sort of grew up on this stuff in a lot of ways, and it's been interesting to kind of go back and see how it's changed over time.
Lawrence, I gather from your intro, this is not actually part of your normal consumption at all.
Well, yes and no. I watched John Oliver. I love John Oliver. I watched The Day Show at the height of my collegiate political angry about George W. Bush heights. And so I was very much in tune with that. I kind of fell off of The Daily Show once Jon Stewart left, but I came back whenever Jon Stewart came back. And so I've been watching that once a week. It's quite good. Really, really enjoy that. But my relationship to the satire, like I remember watching Dennis Miller.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, I believe that was an HBO show. Kind of enjoy that, but I don't have a deep relationship to this stuff. Now, I do have a relationship to stuff like Desus and Mero, which is not quite satire, but it is doing funny commentary on the news. They've kind of since broken up, but I really enjoyed that. As I said earlier, one thing I watched religiously when I was a kid was Arsenio Hall, and that was him kind of doing the night show thing, but there was a little bit of satire in it, right? And I like movies that kind of deal with this, but like more along the lines like Hollywood Shuffle, things like this. So my relationship with like a daily news kind of thing or a weekly news kind of thing, I do not have a great relationship with it. But I mostly watch Last Week Tonight, and that's about it. There was once a show on VH1 called The Best Week Ever. I don't even know if you guys even know about this show.
No.
It was called The Best Week Ever.
I remember that show.
And it was kind of in this vein, and I really enjoyed that when I was a kid. But like, I just don't have that much relationship. So to hear Al go real deep on the British connections and the British origins of this, I'm going to have to tip my hat to him and you guys, because I really don't have that much of a relationship to it. Now, the stuff that I watched for this, I was intrigued by, didn't find it very funny. It feels like The Onion to me. Like, it's something that every now and then you'll get a good chuckle out of it, but it just doesn't engage me on that level. I think I'm just, I don't know. I have a black heart, I think is what it is. And I'm just very cynical. Maybe that's what my problem is.
That opens the door to a really interesting first discussion, which is what the relationship of political satire, especially in the way that people like Jon Stewart and John Oliver do it, to humor. Because in both cases, it seems like, from my experience, I love both of those guys. It's especially gratifying to hear you all talk about how much you love John Oliver, because he was, as he said many times himself, was a spectacularly moderately successful comedian in the UK and never really made a name for himself, although I was familiar with him because he had bit appearances on a lot of these kinds of shows. And obviously now is a huge megastar in the US, and I'm made up for him. But both him and Jon Stewart are funny. They are reliably funny. I will always laugh when I'm watching their shows. But in the case of Jon Stewart, what I go to him for is not necessarily the jokes. It's moral clarity, which for my money, he does better than almost anyone else on TV.
Agreed.
And John Oliver, it's about approachable investigative journalism, which seems to be what his real forte is. And especially in the case of John Oliver, like a lot of the bits are only kind of moderately funny at best, but it is still one of the best shows on TV because of the huge amount of effort that they put into the reporting that they do.
There's an article in the New York Times. Actually, it was an interview on their podcast with John Oliver, just came out a few weeks ago.
I did see that.
And they talk a lot about where you draw the line when it's journalism and when it's a comedy show. And I know that Jon Stewart and John Oliver both fall on the side of this is a comedy show, you know, don't come to us for your news. But both shows are rigorously fact-checked. They have to be, you know, they really have to be. They're very careful about where they slide in their jokes. I mean, it is just like you said, Al, they work so hard on both of those programs. And I'm sure that they work really hard on all of the other ones too. But that was a major contention, I think, for him, because I think a lot of reporters actually look at the practices, especially in John Oliver's show, that are journalistic practices. Mm. It really leans heavily on that, even though he insists it's not, it's a comedy show.
I heard that interview and I thought it was really revealing. And I thought John Oliver was kidding himself, essentially, when he kept falling back on this, like, you know, we're careful about what we do, but ultimately we're a comedy show. Mm-hmm. No, John, you're the main source of information on this kind of news for almost all of your audience. And I don't know why he's not comfortable owning that.
Yeah, I don't know either. Because when you think about news, you know, and you think about satirical news, often the viewer comes in already having been informed of what's going on, right? So you kind of have that a little bit of a background information, which is part of what makes it funny, the satirical news funny. However, John Oliver will take a particular topic that I know nothing about. I am learning about this topic.
He does
through
that really good.
A comedy show, you know, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's the fundamentally new thing, that for any kind of satire, you know, there's an educational aspect of it, that reading Mad Magazine was how I learned about what adults were watching on TV, what adults were watching as films. And so, you know, the only thing I know about Ed Meese or something is from, like, not necessarily the news, which was not making any kind of commentary. And it was just these early news or Monty Python news stuff, just because the person reading in a very serious way and telling you serious things is just an amazing target for satire. Mm-hmm. Of course, you want to pierce that bubble of seriousness. So there's that, you know, that's the foundation. That's the foundation of what The Onion was. But even The Onion sometimes has a really trenchant take on something that, like, the irony, the way that it's making an ironic point is actually getting at something very difficult for us to process. And that's been, I think, whatever your political persuasion, there are media outlets that we use to be our companions and make the hard things go down and help us to understand and give us more clarity, as you were saying, Al. So we haven't brought up Bill Maher yet, but, you know, I don't know if he's anywhere near ratings wise as bit, but he's certainly,
I don't know what to do with that guy,
as accessible. But Bill Maher is closer to, like, a Rush Limbaugh or somebody like that, where so many of these radio guys, these podcast guys, they do with commentary on the news and they're jokey about it. Even like the National Review podcast, like, they're making jokes constantly against the people that they don't like. One of the things in looking at this That's Not Funny book, you know, Trump fancies himself a comedian, and so many of the things that we look at that we object to are him trying to be funny, that anybody that's at all smart that likes Trump, it's because they find him funny and they find him, you know, very much like probably we are about Biden. Like, oh, isn't that funny how he's a little out of it? And what a funny old grandpa. And that's the way they look at Trump. So they're laughing with Trump at the same, you know, but it's still laughing all the way down. You know, this is just part of the ways that we tolerate the world.
That gets at a really interesting criticism that you can levy at the whole cottage industry of funny news in general and satire in general, is that one effect it seems to have is to make figures and political stories that we ought to be wary of or scared of or intimidated by somehow funny, kind of pierces the significance of them. Less people like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, but the kind of talk show hosts who do funny news routines at the opening of their shows, talked about Donald Trump in 2016, and much more directly the way that Boris Johnson in the UK appeared on a lot of less satirical panel shows. He's very funny, very charismatic guy, very smart, and can get a panel and get an audience on side very, very easily. A lot of people credited Boris Johnson's rise to power in the UK directly with his successful appearances on the show Have I Got News For You, where he hosted and did a great job and became, like, much loved by the viewing population as a result. That's something that show definitely has to reckon with, is his political legacy and the role that they played in facilitating it.
Sounds like The Apprentice, what it did for Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing, building a myth.
I mean, never having actually watched a whole episode of The Apprentice, I can't actually say much about this, but my impression was that is not funny and that part of the appeal of that it's a much different.
It was kind of funny.
Was The Apprentice trying to be funny?
It was funny at times.
In a Simon Cowell sort of sense of, like,
yeah,
he's such a badass.
Yeah, like, right. You know. Yeah.
He was a caricature. I mean, he is a caricature. But it does, I think, the same thing that it did for, it sounds like, Boris Johnson too. Just, it created this myth, and that's what we were playing with in 2016.
Do people who are progressive liberals, are they the ones who tend to do this kind of comedy, or are conservatives doing the comedy? Because I maybe am just not aware of what's going on Fox News, and maybe they're doing that there. But it just seems like this is a strain of thought. Like, Bill Maher has kind of moved into a weird realm now. He's kind of
weird. He's an old guy. Old guys are libertarian. They tend to, you know, they want to be pre-woke. And so even Seinfeld is doing this, what in this book, that's not funny, they call it paleo comedy. You know, where it's like, oh, well, the good old days when things were simpler and people weren't all vegan and trans and whatever.
I think that's an old guy thing. But my question is this like something, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say, Al, as well, because in America, it seems like the ones that are really successful and the ones that I really gravitate towards are the left-leaning ones. John Oliver, John Stewart. Is that just a feature of how this works, or are they doing it on the conservative side as well?
I think it's an incredibly interesting question. I think most conservative comics or conservative viewers would probably say that conservative comedy exists, but is kind of censored or crowded out of the market because the liberal elites who own TV networks are only interested in showcasing liberal comedians. I think there's a much more interesting answer to this, which is that if you're an actual conservative, as in part of your political ideology is traditions, traditional power structures, traditional institutions ought to be respected and preserved, it's much, much harder to then do satire, because the point of satire is to take exactly those things and show them to be ridiculous.
Great point, Al.
And that's very easy for a liberal to do, and it's very hard for a conservative to do. And I don't think that means conservatives can't be funny. Clearly, they can be very funny. They can also be very good satirists, but they have to be the kind of conservative who are minded to poke fun at these institutions. And when modern conservative satire exists, it strikes me that what it's trying to do is to substitute liberal orthodoxies for those kinds of institutions. And the reason that fails, in my view, is because they're just not the same kind of thing.
That is so smart. I hadn't really thought about it in that way. But when all of this really blew up, like in the modern era, it was during Bush 2.0, it was basically humor as a way to speak to who's in power, right? It was to take them down a couple pegs. And that was automatically going to have a more liberal point of view as well. You know, just the timing of it, when it all kind of blew up, happened at a time when there was a conservative in office here in the States.
What a difference a year makes. You may think not a lot can change in that time, but most programs at Salt Lake Tech can be completed in 6 to 18 months. Last year, I was working odd jobs. This year, I'm building my future with a new career as a certified nursing assistant. Earning a certificate is affordable and flexible and gets me career ready. Explore programs in healthcare, electronics, manufacturing, automotive, and more. Enroll at slcc.edu. Salt Lake Tech, careers that work.
I think it's also really important to take note of the fact that Jon Stewart's main target when he first started seemed to me to be the news media itself and the kind of hypocrisies and the fact that it was George Bush is not a coincidence, because of the Iraq war and because of tremendous amounts of political bullshit which was swirling in the media ecosystem around the time of the Iraq war. But I think it was the bullshit that was Jon Stewart's target every bit as much as conservatism as such. Honestly, it was the fact that you were living in the Fox News era and CNN's response was to try and out-Fox Fox News, and MSNBC then followed suit. That seems to me to be the stuff that Jon Stewart was taking really sharp aim at. I mean, the bullshit mountain stuff, that bit that he would do every show is just incredibly on point. And then Stephen Colbert following up by being a direct satire of a conservative news presenter was just was fantastic and is just very on the nose.
Yes, so good.
And necessary at the time.
Yeah, you're right. And it also came of age at a time when everything was politicized. So we didn't have Fox News in the 80s when not necessarily the news was popular. It was really just making fun of just the news, of the format, really, instead of the content. Well, there was some content in there, but it was really more about, let's make fun of this format. And it definitely shifted when everything became so partisan in the late 90s and early aughts.
Again, the main point of this book that I keep referring to is how, for us liberal elites, that the success of comedy on the right has been invisible to us. That Gutfeld actually does better right now than probably any of these other shows that we're talking about. Maybe because it is the choice. Jesse Waters is on the same station and sort of brings some humor in, but it's not primarily a humor format. But yeah, Gutfeld does exactly the kind of thing. I more like Bill Maher than John Oliver exactly, but it's just playing on a different sensibility. And like, that's the place that people go. Whereas we have liberals have so many more choices. Like, I don't particularly like Colbert's current political takes. I just find them shallow. I still think he's pretty funny, but like, I'm definitely not going to learn anything. And when there is something, like when Andrew Yang was running and had the proposals for direct payments to people, is something that should be seriously considered. And so the fact that he was so dismissive about that and just making sort of obvious jokes without actually interrogating it in any careful way made me just think, okay, this is a fine, what the Tonight Show monologue is supposed to be, you know, what that kind of thing, but not what we're getting from the things we primarily have in mind now when we talk about, you know, that are actually informative, that actually you could use this as your primary news source. Not that you necessarily should use it as your only news source, but certainly a lot of the things that John Oliver, as we've said, is bringing up is like well-researched stuff on things that you would probably not read about otherwise, including things that are horrific. So it's not just all, it's the lighter side of the news.
No, like, it's just that when I think about this and doing the research and looking into this, liberals are like feasting when it comes to this kind of news. We have it all over the place. We can get it on the night shows. We can get it on special news shows. But when I look at the demographic of, say, America, there are so many conservatives in this country, right? And it seems as though there should be something that would feed to them, because I'm not a person who thinks that because a person is conservative, they are therefore evil. I can't buy that. They tend to be weird in the way that they think. And I really don't like a lot of them, but I don't think they're evil, right? You know, I live in Oklahoma. I'm surrounded by these people, right? So I don't think they're evil, but it just seems like there is a clear market for people who are conservative leaning doing this kind of stuff. And capitalism dictates that someone should be filling that void. Like, someone should be doing that kind of satire. And maybe I'm just not in the know. Maybe I just don't subscribe to the right podcast and the right thing. So there is a whole conservative onion style thing that's happening. I'm just not aware of it. But I don't understand how conservatives don't have this. I don't get it. Now, the only thing that's gotten close to explaining this to me was what Al said, because Al is really smart. But outside of that, I genuinely don't know why it's not happening for them.
I do think basically that the answer I gave previously is the right one. The broader point, I think, is that your political leanings make certain kinds of culture more or less available to you. So if you're a liberal, if you're a progressive, maybe it's harder for you to get on board with mainstream country music, say, or Christian rock or whatever else it may be.
I think you're right about that. That's a profound observation.
It's not that if you're a conservative, you can't like punk rock music, but there's a tension there. There's something weird in the idea of a conservative punk band, the Ramones notwithstanding. They are the example of the conservative punk band.
Well, one guy was conservative.
One guy.
And,
you know, if you're looking at Blink-182, one of them's a conspiracist now, but whatever. But you get the point, right? It's hard to...
They're all guys.
If you're a... It makes certain kinds of culture less accessible to you. I mean, in the realm of hip hop as well, like, is there such a thing as conservative hip hop? I'm sure there is, but...
No, I promise you there's not many. I know of none.
And that doesn't mean that no Trump voters are into Wu-Tang, but...
Kanye West might be. Kanye West?
Possibly, but he's an aberration, right? And that's the point.
Right. Now I'm picturing Sonic Youth breaking up because Ken Gordon becomes Marjorie Taylor Greene. Sorry.
That hasn't happened, right?
No.
Please.
To be honest, that is such a good observation. It makes me feel like we should do an entire episode about music and political leanings. Cause I had never thought of it like punk rock being kind of progressive, you know, left leaning hip hop, progressive left leaning country music, conservative. Al, you're on one of them. Man, you're throwing the heat today, man. Good job, Al.
I think it all kind of speaks to the fact that it all lives in the entertainment industry, like everything does. And the entertainment industry tends to be pretty lefty. And it's hard to be, you do have your Rob Schneiders, for example. He's still a successful comedian, but he's also turned into a right-wing nut job. But there aren't too many of them. they're not dominating for sure. I think it's part of the fact that so much of this is left is just because it's part of the entertainment industry, which is left.
This is something that brings us on to another kind of criticism of the whole affair, is that so often it's left, and that's because maybe it has to do with like the points that I made, as in you have to like be that way to do this kind of culture. Or maybe it's because the audience that they're looking for is progressive. But a lot of the time when the entertainment industry is progressive, especially with a capital P, it's clearly being progressive in a cynical and performative way. So while a lot of the, like maybe a lot of the art, a lot of the talent maybe is genuinely ideologically on one side of the spectrum, the business that they all operate in is very conservative in a lot of respects. Like they're not going to take chances. The bottom line is the important thing. And you know that those execs are voting with their bank balance on the main and not with their ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
I think eugenics might be a good idea.
I'm just sorry. If there's punk songs that are the record company, like, you know, maybe not. Maybe we can't release this. Sorry. Dead Kennedys. Your name was offensive enough. We thought,
talk about satirical, but I mean, yeah, we're not talking about satirical music, but California Ruberalis is an absolute masterpiece.
I think this question about political conservative comedy gets us to podcasts. So, I mean, once we're getting to panel shows, once we're getting to just commentary, once we're getting to Rush Limbaugh or whatever, it seems there is a continuum, right? That we're not getting this straight up. It's not a satire of news. Did you guys listen when Air America.
Yeah, I remember that.
I like when it went on the air and listening to the Stuart Smalley, what's his actual name? Our esteemed ex-groping
senator
from Minnesota.
He wasn't actually groping. He was pretending to grope.
There were reports in various photos of him squeezing women's bottoms. And that was the multiple people that brought that up, of him being a little too handsy. That was the main. If it had only been the alleged pretending to grope, that would not have been enough. The Al Franken show. So that was pretty funny.
Oh, Al Franken.
Yeah. Sorry.
How do you pretend to grope? That doesn't make any sense. It's fine.
I mean, there was a photo of him where she was asleep and it was a conservative person, woman who then made us think about
decided to blow up everything. Yeah. Anyway, but we do have Joe Rogan.
Yes.
He's a big time podcaster, and maybe that DIY kind of effect of what podcasting is. He's independently doing his own thing, and it's really resonated with a lot of conservatives.
Joe Rogan's just really fun. Joe Rogan deserves a podcast discussion all in
he's
his own right.
He's
a fascinating phenomenon.
He's really fascinating.
He's gross.
But most relevantly for this discussion,
then I would have to sit through a lot of his episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Most relevantly for this discussion, I think one of his defining features is that he is completely tone deaf about his responsibilities as an interviewer and his responsibilities as a major entertainer. And he has managed to live with this self-delusion that as long as he's just asking questions, it doesn't matter how stupid or misleading or leading the questions that he's asking are. And it doesn't matter how dangerous, deluded, or misinformed the guests that he's asking these questions of are. And I think that relates generally to the issue of satirical news, because as we talked about before, these satirists have a far bigger impact on politics and culture than they're probably comfortable admitting, like especially we talked about John Oliver, but even John Stewart, he I'm sure will always see himself as an external figure in the political discourse, someone who's standing on the sidelines and commenting, but he has single-handedly shaped so much of the American political culture. I think you could legitimately argue that John Stewart's success is the single most significant reason why conservatives have felt victimized in the political culture over the last 20 or 30 years, because they have found themselves being ruthlessly made fun of very, very effectively every single day, and they've got nothing to counter it.
Mm-hmm. Except Joe Rogan.
You know, in watching the little bit of Gutfeld that I just watched, his episode from a couple days ago, that he's doing a very much a mirror image and not being like, I think we might overlook when John Oliver is just straight up insulting people. You fucking ass. Like that he will, and Gutfeld will do the same thing. He'll have a joke, but then he'll just put in like, you twerp, you whatever, you know, maybe if you have a delightful British accent, we're not supposed to take it as mean or something. But Yeah, mixing up the jokes with the straight up insults and pausing to, and that thing that Trump did was actually really awesome. And the fact that you don't recognize that means you're a pile of trash. You know, just these mixing in. Whereas with Limbaugh or something, it's primarily about the outrage with an occasional joke. Now it's just a matter of shifting that it's about the jokes, but we're still using it to put the outrage through.
Talk a little more about this guy, because I didn't see any of his shows. Like, who are his targets? Like, what's he taking aim at?
Yeah, it's like, didn't Kamala sound really drunk? Here's a clip. She sounds absolutely insane. So it's the kind of thing, again, like the famous Howard Dean scream. Like, you could just say that that's kind of funny.
Ah, I'm sorry. That was funny.
But you still like Howard Dean. Or you could use, as actually happened historically, that it completely derailed his entire thing. So I think people try to do that with Trump because he says so many things that should be disqualifying. And so he's doing the reverse, that when Tim Walz or Harris or somebody else does something that is a little bit weird or cloying, or just that when taken out of context can be easily made fun of, then yes, let's make fun of that and show that, say, how it is symptomatic of how intellectually bankrupt the Democrats are.
Is that the extent of the analysis? In their better moments, people like Jon Stewart will make the funny joke about the silly thing that Trump said, but then tie it into some substantive policy issue. Mm-hmm. Do they go that far, or is it just is it just the surface?
I would have to watch more than the 20 minutes or whatever that I made myself sit through, because it was a little difficult. I didn't realize this book brought up that there are a few sort of main philosophical systems of humor or theories about humor. And one of them that goes all the way back to Thomas Hobbes is that humor is just expressing your superiority over the thing you're laughing at. So it's bullying, right? That's a primary humor. And we as modern people are like, well, that's not real humor. That's like immature humor. But no, it actually might be a pretty central core thing. And this is what we could have a whole thing of, like, is Trump actually funny in any way? He certainly has the shtick of a stand-up comedian, but, you know, when he was on Saturday Night Live or just the, you know, what you hear him, he seems like he just has a terrible sense of humor. But yet, you know, is this just a matter of, you know, well, it's just not my sensibility?
Well, since you brought up Thomas Hobbes, I feel justified in dropping some more wanky theory, which is that traditionally you can separate satire into two distinct strands, what's called Horatian satire and Juvenalian satire. And Juvenalian satire is exactly the stuff that you've just described. It's taking a powerful figure and exaggerating something about them to make them ridiculous. And Horatian is making fun of people very directly. That's the kind of stuff that you saw in Punch magazine in like the 19th century, National Lampoon-y. Horatian satire is the more kind of cerebral kind, where you're teasing out absurdities in political situations or political structures or what have you. And that's the kind of satire which starts from a kind of morally superior position. That's what Jon Stewart and the like are up to, apart from when they're just making fun of how stupid Donald Trump looks, in which case it's Juvenalian.
The conservatives definitely think that they're doing both kinds, right? That they are morally superior, and this thing you just said just shows how morally bankrupt you are. Yeah, absolutely.
We haven't talked about the audience, the live audience. Like, so many of these are performances in front of a live audience. So not only do you get the presenter's view, they're the ones telling the jokes, but then you have people in the background who are laughing and clapping and, you know, and all of that. And I listened to Bill Maher. I listened to his latest show on the way home from work yesterday. And I was just struck by how much of a role the live audience plays in the whole vibe of the show. Have you guys thought about that at all? About how that would contribute to how we think about people in power?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it kind of speaks to how old-fashioned the form is, because a lot of other kinds of comedy have, I wouldn't want to say evolved past the laugh track, but, you know, they've evolved past the laugh track. I'm thinking now of The Thick of It, which is a British TV show, which was the precursor to Veep, which is an intensely funny satire, like satire in the truest sense, because it's it has the form of a fly on the wall documentary about civil servants in Whitehall and all the crap that they have to put up with and get up to. The absence of the laugh track there really intensifies a lot of the jokes, which are coming from how like ridiculous and cringy the positions that these people find themselves in are in. But the live audience, particularly in a context of political satire, really, really adds to the experience of being a part of the joke, right? You're in on the joke. You're not one of the people being made fun of. You're part of the group doing the fun making, which is the comforting experience.
What a difference a year makes. You may think not a lot can change in that time, but most programs at Salt Lake Tech can be completed in 6 to 18 months. Last year, I was working odd jobs. This year, I'm building my future with a new career as a certified nursing assistant. Earning a certificate is affordable and flexible and gets me career ready. Explore programs in healthcare, electronics, manufacturing, automotive, and more. Enroll at slcc.edu. Salt Lake Tech, careers that work.
Hey moms, looking for some lighthearted guidance on this crazy journey we call parenting?
Join me, Sabrina Kohlberg.
And me, Andy Mitchell, for Pop Culture Moms,
where each week we talk about what we're watching
and examine our favorite pop culture moms up close to try to pick up some parenting hacks along the way.
Come laugh, learn, and grow with us as we look for the best tips
and maybe a few what not to do's from our favorite fictional moms.
From Good Morning America and ABC Audio,
Pop Culture Moms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Maybe it's back to the bullying point and just like live audiences.
Yeah, I know. That's what made me think about it. It does sound a little bit like bullying.
It's kind of uncomfortable, isn't it?
I mean, you guys probably don't know how much the laugh track contributes to this podcast because you probably don't listen to it after the production, but I've added in the laugh track just constantly.
Huh. I think laugh tracks work better when people are actually laughing. As opposed to a track that you put in to make it sound good.
Sure.
Yeah, we want the genuine laughs, Mark.
Yeah.
Yes. No, even in the sitcom world, it's such a cheesy, just a cliche of like have that laugh track there. But then when you actually think of it, or if the show is good enough that you could see like, oh no, it's actually better that this is done in front of a live audience and that people are actually laughing at this. And then there's something genuine about that. I guess it just depends to what extent the applause sign, how manipulated are these audiences? Even with the shows that we're talking about, to what extent is John Oliver's audience seeing a time to laugh? Like, probably I wouldn't think so, but
I mean, no, they probably have one.
But you don't need the light because he's a stand-up comedian and he's doing structured jokes. So the audience knows when he.
True.
The third clause in the sentence after the setup, after this, we've got to laugh now. And then everyone left. Mm-hmm. It's all manipulative.
When I was in college, I went and saw Dennis Miller do his show sat at one of the tapings. And this is before he turned into a crazy person. And
Sarah, not everybody who's conservative is not crazy. He's just conservative. Sorry. Your liberal leanings is leading you to say these things.
Thanks, Lawrence. Tell me something I don't know. but anyway, we went and we watched Dennis Miller do his shtick. And there were times that people would laugh and applaud that weren't prompted by a sign or anything like that. But it was definitely, you know, like at the beginning of the show, you are clapping so long, your palms hurt so that they can get it all in. But there are definite natural breaks. And I think that we kind of feel that, you know, as a viewer, we know when something is genuine, or at least we like to think we do.
Is this a problem, though? There's a genius comedian from the UK called Stuart Lee, and he has a brutally funny joke about political comedy where he's talking about the kind of political comedy he does and the audience that comes to see it. And he said, oh, so you all go home afterwards and someone asks you, was the show funny? And you go, no, but I agreed with all of it, so it was great.
Oh man, ouch, brutal.
Is a lot Jesus of political Christ. Comedy does seem to serve a function of being just political oratory, because we don't really have a space in our culture for people to stand up and deliver political oratory anymore. And a lot of the time, political comedy does just seem to be political oratory smuggled in, where the point is not to be funny, but to say things that the audience agree with and want to hear somebody say. I don't know if it's a problem, but it seems slightly dishonest, at least.
It does. I mean, let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, when I was younger, I went to a recording of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I went to a recording of the television show The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
And if Which you episode were thinking, was it?
I'm not going to tell you because I don't remember. If you think back to The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, it was recorded in a live studio audience. And so people were laughing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I went there And it ruined the experience for me. I could never watch another episode of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air because here's what I learned by going and sitting in this recording. They had this thing where they would say, laugh here or laugh crazily. Or there would be producers who would say, all right, a really funny joke is happening. When this person tells this joke, I need you to really laugh, guys. Get ready for it. And so a person tell a joke and there'd be this lady over here. And it really messed it up for me. I was never able to like watch Family Matters. These are shows you have no idea what that's about. Because I began to realize that it was not genuine, that the reaction that the crowd was giving was not an authentic reaction. So that is to say, if I learned that there was producers who were telling the audience of John Oliver's show to laugh at this joke that's about to happen, I don't think I could watch it anymore because it doesn't have that. It needs to be genuine. Jon Stewart is a genuinely funny comedian. John Oliver is as well. If there's something artificial about the crowd's reaction to what's happening, it wouldn't work for me. And I don't care if I do agree with it. It wouldn't work for me because part of it is, yes, it's good to learn something new, but it needs to be entertaining. You are putting on a television show. And if the show part feels artificial, I'm not going to like it anymore. So I hope that they don't do that. I hope that it's real.
I was trying to find, I remember hearing a podcast at some time with some writer who had left, who was a writer on Last Week Tonight and had left it because he just felt like the politics are taking over and it's not about the humor. And that's just unfortunate. Hmm. It's a trade-off, right? Even just writing jokes it's artificial, right? That when Jon Stewart did his straight up interview show on Apple TV before he came back here,
it didn't work very well.
I didn't watch more than two episodes because it was just like, here's my podcast where I'm being very earnest and sort of redundant about interviewing a number of guests about the same thing. I saw this Burn Pit episode and like it accomplished something. They outlawed, you know, they gave veterans benefits to people affected by burn pits. I think largely because he put these politicians' feet to the fire. So that's very authentic, but it's not very entertaining. Like I like having it spoon fed to me. This is what even a regular news show, right? You want the writing to be good, the visuals to be sharp. Why do all these articles, news articles, have to have pictures? Do I need another picture of Donald Trump? No, please just tell me the information. No, but no, we got to dress everything up in all formats. So, you know, just how different is it to put in some humor element than to just like have an attractive person delivering it? Like, are those really fundamentally different kinds of things?
I think a lot of this has to do with the place that satire has like historically in the culture. And if you're someone like Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, or if you're John Oliver, right, and you can consider yourself a satirist, then you have a baked in reason for why you're doing the comedy. Why are you dressing it up with jokes? Because we're doing satire, and satire is talking about the news, but making it funny. But really, I think there's a good argument that what they're doing isn't satire at all and is just comedy news. It's like, Weekend Update, right, which is a satire only insofar as it looks like a news broadcast. Otherwise, it's just a joke delivery mechanism and has nothing to do with highlighting absurdities in politics or making fun of powerful figures necessarily. It's just a joke delivery mechanism. And if you're John Oliver or one of his writers and you have to like just look from first principles and say, look, clearly what John Oliver and company are interested in doing is talking about these underserved political issues, then you have to ask the question, like, why be funny? Does it serve the interest of what we're trying to do at core? Like, is the point you were making, Mark? Like, is this necessary window dressing? And if you're a satirist, then the answer is yes, because satire has to be funny. That's what the whole deal is. But if you aren't a satirist and you're just choosing to do news, but in a funny way, then you do have to kind of account for that. And I think that's why John Oliver struggles to account for it, because really he could do all the best bits about what he's doing without making any jokes and maybe more effectively. But because there's this concept, he's got this conception of himself as a satirist, it has to be funny.
And so do we. That's how we see him too. Mm. I'm not going to watch his show for a lecture about how terrible prisons are or something, for example, right? That's not why I'm going. I will get the lecture about how terrible prisons are, but it will also be given to us with a little bit of...
A spoonful of sugar.
Sugar. Yes, a spoonful of sugar. We need that in order to help process. some of the terrible things that are happening in our world.
Yeah, because John Oliver's numbers are a lot bigger than PBS Frontlines.
Right.
I wonder if the moral clarity requirement itself might be seriously falsifying. Like, the best political podcast interviews that I hear are ones that can be honest about the difficulties of issues in a way that no politician is allowed to be. No politician, I mean, even though it's absolutely the truth, Kamala is not allowed to say, look, I realize a lot of people are going to vote just because the economy is better because of inflation. But, you know, inflation was a worldwide thing, right? You know that the studies show maybe our plan contributed a little bit to it, but we thought that was outweighed by giving aid to a lot of different people. These are just obvious things that I feel like
you can't say.
Certainly a politician can't say. And I don't think a forum like Last Week Tonight is optimal for actually making us understand the nuances of things either. I don't know. What do you think of that? He certainly tries.
He tries, but he's limited by the form that he's chosen to do the job. But then So is everyone else. When it comes to moral clarity, I think the bigger test is how people handle partisanship, because so many of the people that we've talked about are very, very strongly partisan. But something I admire hugely about Jon Stewart is he's genuinely not afraid to call out people who are on his side when he thinks they're being disingenuous.
Yep.
He was the only I think he deserves enormous credit for this, is the only person in the kind of Democratic media establishment who I remember calling out Joe Biden's incapacity to run for office again, like when it was patently obvious, when everybody else was still making excuses for him, including Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and all those other fellow travelers. Mm-hmm. And he has also been one of the most consistently correct on, like, in his discussion of Israel and Gaza and the kinds of play. He's just fearless in what he decides to talk about. And the positions that he puts forward, even when they're not ultimately ones that I agree with or that boil over into the popular culture, they are clearly considered, honest, and genuine. And that's the kind of moral clarity that I think gives him the influence that he does and commands respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what makes him Jon Stewart.
And I really enjoyed him, and watching him come back and then watching him in juxtaposition to John Oliver, I realized what makes Jon Stewart so special. Because John Oliver, he's clever, he's funny, he's entertaining, but he's, listen, I'm a progressive. Like, he's really progressive. Everything he's saying is very progressive. And I think there's a lot of nuance to a lot of stuff that's happening in the world. And that's the reason why I keep wondering about conservatism, because I would actually listen to that. Now, I don't want to listen to the right-wing nut jobs, as Sarah has called them, but I do want to listen to someone who is thoughtful, who's conservative, and can, like, give me the other side. Because at the core, I may be progressive, but Mark knows about this. I'm a philosopher. I want to hear it. I want to hear both sides and come to my own conclusion. And so I think that is something that is so needed. And right now, we are so partisan that people just listen to the people that they agree with, and they get their beliefs reinforced by listening to those things. Whereas I think that someone like Jon Stewart is so important, because Jon Stewart will be progressive when he believes it. But Al, he gives that moral clarity that you're talking about. He does say things like, I was scandalized at first when I heard Jon Stewart talk about what was going on with Joe Biden, because everything else I was listening to was, we got to support him. We got to beat Trump. But he was the only one out there on the Hill. I mean, not the only one. I'm sure there are other people who are talking behind the scenes, but he was the one who was saying, guys, we got to do something about this. Something needs to change here. And so that's what I really, really think that Jon Stewart brings to the equation. I think you're absolutely right. And I would enjoy more people who are along that kind of leaning. Someone who's just really willing to say, outside of Bill Maher and the weird stuff, because he kind of does that, but he does it in a weird way. Outside of that, someone who says, when it's progressive, I agree with it, I like it, but this is progressives are doing something weird, I don't agree with that, we need to look at the other side. I think Jon Stewart is absolutely hitting out the park.
It seems like you're pointing at something that has not aged well with the idea of politically incorrect, right? Bill Maher's old.
Oh, yeah.
Because it used to be that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're saying something. I don't know. At this point, like, what is the point of saying something vaguely anti-trans? I mean, I guess this is what Dave Chappelle is doing.
He's backed off of it.
That he can make the sort of common sense, I'm putting this in quotes, just, you know, the content of his shtick in that regard. Yeah, I don't know if he's really backed off of that. But yes, this is, do we see this as like, oh, this is the speaking truth to whatever side of the political aisle you're on? No, it just seems like it's just expressing your idiosyncratic opinion.
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know if I see this as a great moral. Yeah. Everybody should sort of be doing that. I mean, it's just, I'm sure there are things that John Oliver picks on that are not like the Democratic consensus, but that he feels like he has to make a big deal about, or, you know, have any of these figures been, I can't support either of these people because they support the genocide in Gaza, right? This is a, this is something I see on Facebook a lot. Mm-hmm. And it seems like an obvious thing for a comedian to take this point of view, but I have not actually seen that.
I think that gets at another really interesting potential criticism with especially the Jon Stewarts and John Olivers of the world, which is that in order to do the kind of satire or political comedy that they're doing, you have to be in the establishment to a very significant degree.
Yeah.
No one who sits in Jon Stewart's chair is ever going to be the kind of person who will say, I think the morally correct choice is to vote for a third party, because they have to be, you know, at the heart of a media empire for which that is not an acceptable political position. You know, we can argue about how reasonable it is to want to vote for a third party in America, but the fact remains that no one on a major television network presenting a show is ever going to say that that's the right call, because if you have that kind of fringe political position, you don't get to sit in Jon Stewart's chair.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think John Oliver in that same interview talked about Jimmy Kimmel using his platform to talk about healthcare when his son was sick. And I was thinking about that more, about using the moral obligation that one must feel when you are in that position to use it for quote unquote good, right? What you think is good. So it's essentially becomes an opinion piece that is often very funny, but it's used in a way for them to get out the message that they think is right.
I've just had nothing to disagree with there.
Yeah.
I had nothing. Good job.
That's okay.
Good job, Sarah. You're smart.
Well, it seems like we should wrap up here. We can share a few more, at least those of us that can stick around can share a few more stories from this area. But thanks for listening. We knew this is going to come out after the election. I'm predicting before the election is actually decided, but yet after the election. That's not a very controversial.
Does anybody want to give their predictions on who's going to win? Anybody want to go out there?
I'm so stressed out.
That can wait for the after talk.
I think. Yeah.
Tune in to find out who's going to win.
Patreon.com/prettymuchpop if you wanted to get into that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, you folks, for coming on. So long.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.
What a difference a year makes. You may think not a lot can change in that time, but most programs at Salt Lake Tech can be completed in 6 to 18 months. Last year, I was working odd jobs. This year, I'm building my future with a new career as a certified nursing assistant. Earning a certificate is affordable and flexible and gets me career ready. Explore programs in healthcare, electronics, manufacturing, automotive, and more. Enroll at slcc.edu. Salt Lake Tech, careers that work.